Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a contributor to the Bulwark. And I'm joined by my colleague, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, great to be with you as always.
Well, same here, Eric, and I am particularly looking forward to this episode of Shield of the Republic because I get to play the role of one of my favorite Dostoevskian characters, the Grand Inquisitor. And so that I can explain to our listeners what this entails, as Eric ruefully shakes his head. Eric's been extraordinarily prolific last few weeks. He's written articles about isolationism in the Republican Party, about Iranian nuclear learning, and about what do you do with recalcitrant NATO members and the nominal belief that there has to be unanimity. And what I thought we might do for this session is I'd give Eric the floor and work through with him how do you deal with these problems. And you know, I will pay my friend and colleague a compliment. You know, he has a great ability to conceptualize and certainly to put things in deep historical context. But as you were saying in the green room, you know, it's one thing to admire the problem; it's another thing to actually figure out what to do about it. So we'll see how good you are at figuring out how to do things about real world problems. I think in each case, Eric, if it's okay with you, what I'd like to ask you to do is summarize your argument. So maybe let's start, let's start with the Iranian question. Maybe leave the future of the GOP for last. This is an article that you wrote with Ray Take and Ruhul Gurecht. Could you just spell out what is the argument of the article?
Well, Elliot, I know you've been, you know, soft soaping me here because now you're, you know, really going to put the thumb screws to me to come up with answers to all these problems.
It was just a setup, Eric.
I know. Believe me, I know. So this is a subject that Ray Take, who's been a guest on Shield of the Republic, and I have talked about for some time with Ruhul Gurecht, our co-author. And it was prompted by a couple of things, one of which is that while, of course, people's attention has been riveted on the war in Gaza and the role that Iranian proxies are playing throughout the region, not only Hamas, but Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, militias in Iraq. But at the same time, it is clear that the Iranians are, you know, moving forward towards a nuclear capability. Now, they have stepped back a little bit recently, downblending some of their uranium that had been enriched up to 60%, which is very close to, you know, weapons grade. It doesn't take much to go beyond that. And so we wanted to refocus people's attention on the fact that Iran is continuing to make progress towards a nuclear weapon. And we wanted to talk about what happens afterwards, in part because there is kind of a very self-soothing story that people can tell themselves that is rooted in social science. It's rooted in the notion that nuclear weapon states, you know, no matter what they may have behaved like and acted like before they got nuclear weapons, tend to be domesticated to some degree by the reality of actually having nuclear weapons. This goes under the rubric, I think it was Joe Nye of the Kennedy School at Harvard who first articulated this notion. And it was in the context of the U.S.-Soviet relationship that the U.S. and the Soviet Union, through a period of crises, learned certain rules of the road about how to think about nuclear weapons and how to bound the competition over nuclear weapons. And so there is this story that one can tell oneself that, well, you know, Iran, which has sponsored all these proxies, is, you know, engaged in hostage taking, all sorts of risky behaviors. Their propensity for risk will recede once they have nuclear weapons. And the argument that we make in the article is that, you know, the mullahs are not necessarily suicidal. So it doesn't mean that once they have nuclear weapons, they're going to immediately want to use them, but that it is very likely that they will find that the nuclear learning that goes on is going to be on the part of Iran's adversaries. That, for instance, Israel, which is already very, very leery of getting into it with Iran because that of the fact that its proxy Hezbollah sits right on its border with a arsenal of 150,000 rockets and missiles of increasing precision, conventionally armed. But that's already instilled a certain amount of caution in Israel. And the same is likely to be true in Washington, that you know, the degrees of freedom that an American president will have in dealing with crises in the Middle East with Iran will be reduced because of the concern of potential nuclear escalation. We've seen in the Ukraine context what that looks like in terms of the self-deterrence that we've seen in the you know, in the Ukraine context with the Biden administration. And you and I'll get to talk soon, I think, I hope, with Jim Sciutto, who's written about that in a new book, as has David Sanger in the New York Times, but that's, you know, for another day. But in the Iran context, both the U.S. and Israel are likely to be somewhat constrained by Iranian nuclear capability. And Russia and China, for their part, will see Iran as an even more powerful, you know, ally and partner in their efforts to subvert and overturn the international order that the U.S. has led since 1945. So that's the gravamen of the article.
Yeah, I mean, I've never quite understood the argument for why, you know, you would, if you gave a mugger a automatic weapon, that would turn them into a more responsible citizen. You know, maybe they wouldn't immediately try to get into a shootout with the police, but you know, what are the chances that they would use it to conduct more acts of robbery and mayhem? I think pretty high. So let's walk this back. I mean, I clearly agree with that diagnosis. I think, you know, we have set these pretty terrible precedents with the Russians. But first for our listeners, okay, what is the current scope of the Iranian nuclear program? That is obviously at a completely unclassified level. What is it that we can say that they have, the capabilities that they have, unhindered or hindered only at the level that they're hindered now? What would you reasonably expect them to have in 5 or 10 years?
Well, you'll recall that the yardstick that then Secretary of State John Kerry used when negotiating the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015 was that we wanted to have a one-year timeline between the time that Iran made a decision to actually weaponize highly enriched uranium at weapons grade into a weapon, so that you'd have 12 months essentially of lead time. We're now with the amount, even that though the Iranians have now limited themselves a little bit, frankly, I think it's eyewash. It's just basically to keep the heat off of them and to keep, make it harder for the United States to go to the IAEA and get a resolution condemning Iran. And then potentially to the Security Council. And I'm not sure what the Russians would do in the Security Council in any event. But Rafael Grossi, the head of the IAEA, which monitors, was meant to be monitoring all this, has said, first of all, they're not able to monitor everything because there's continuing interference by the Iranians, continuing unwillingness of the Iranians to explain certain anomalies that have cropped up that the IAEA has found in its and reports in it to the Security Council in written form. And that they're basically, we're now talking about, you know, them being, you know, if they made a decision, a matter of weeks away from being able to weaponize and having a few weapons.
From having a few weapons, would they be able to deliver them? I mean, can they put them, would they, do you think that they would be able to, I mean, it's one thing to have a nuclear device, which is a thing that goes bang in the desert, like the Trinity test, for example. It's another thing to do all the stuff you got to do to put it on a ballistic missile and, you know, it can survive the G-forces and it goes off when you want it to go off. How far off are we from them having that capability, do you think?
I mean, look, I think they're pretty far along. I mean, we had evidence of their efforts to work on weaponization and design warheads that went back to the time that you and I were in government. That was an effort led by a gentleman named Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who met an untimely end when an automated machine gun cut him down and killed him. It was his archive, essentially, that the Mossad spirited out of, you know, out of Iran a couple of years ago, back around 2018, I think. And you look, I think all the evidence suggested then and suggests now that it won't take much for them to be able to, you know, pretty quickly have deliverable warheads. Now, my own guess is that they're not going to, quote, break out with only one or two weapons. I think they're going to want to accumulate a lot more highly enriched uranium and be able to have not just three or four, but, you know, 10, 15 weapons. So, you know, we're probably more than 3 or 4 weeks away. But I think, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves. These timelines are, you know, notional.
Do you think we would be able to detect that in time to do something, even something very dramatic?
It's a good question. I don't have a lot of confidence that we would have a lot of indicators or warning. I mean, a lot of, you know, as you'll recall, there was a lot of debate about this at the time of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is now almost 10 years ago. It's hard to, you know, believe, but it was negotiated in 2015. At that time, a lot of advocates in the Obama administration said, oh, we'll have plenty of indications and warning, you know, et cetera. Look, one can argue that the intelligence community of the United States had, you know, 25 years of, you know, indications and warning about India's weapon. I mean, India tested a peaceful nuclear device, as you know, sort of noted, in 1974, and only tested a nuclear weapon for the first time in 1999. And, you know, they caught the American intelligence community completely flat-footed.
Okay, so Eric, let's assume that the Iranians have a handful of nuclear weapons. Let's assume that we're not sure, but there's a good chance that they have nuclear delivery means. If you were sitting in the Situation Room following an event in which we're pretty sure the Iranians had masterminded an attack on American military personnel or have been directly supporting and coaching and equipping the Houthis to launch a missile attack that actually hit an American ship. Under those circumstances, would you be willing to authorize the use of force to, you know, say, kill members of an IRGC cell that had been doing that in Yemen?
In that circumstance, I would be willing to do that, you know, putting aside the nuclear issue. I mean, yeah, actually.
Well, no. I mean, I think, look, you and I have both been pretty robust on that. The question is, what exactly do you think an American government would or should be deterred from doing to a country like Iran, which has nuclear weapons and is threatening to use them, possibly say, maybe they say, you the Americans throw a punch against us, we nuke the Israelis.
Well, you know, that's the conundrum. I mean, you know, once they actually have nuclear weapons, I mean, you know, my preference, of course, is to work backwards and to say we ought to be getting the Europeans right now to
I'm not giving you that option.
No, I know you're not. I'm just saying, you know, there are things we should be doing now to stop this eventuality from happening. Look, I would not have a problem defending freedom of the seas, you know, in the Red Sea, and not worrying about it. I think what you have to worry about at that point is ever hitting anything in Iran, as opposed to hitting the proxies. I mean, look, we went through the entire Cold War having, you know, full on wars with, you know, Soviet proxies, and, you know, didn't ever have a nuclear exchange. So I don't worry about that so much. But you do worry that if you get into a situation where what you have to hit or hold at risk is the Iranian leadership itself or, you know, targets in Iran, then with a nuclear-armed Iran, that becomes a lot dicier. And, of course, you know, you get another government involved. Because in the first instance, we won't be the target. It'll be the Israelis.
Would you be, I'm going to ask you about the Israelis in just a moment, but would you be willing to make the case not for a preemptive nuclear attack on Iranian nuclear facilities? Preemptive, in other words, we think they're about to do something, so we preempt them by attacking it, but a preventive attack on Iranian nuclear facilities, including, you know, the full range of the sort of the weapons, the launch systems, the people who design them and operate them. Would you be willing to do that?
You know, depends on how far advanced the program is, right? You know, so, you know, the odds of success are always dealing with these problems earlier rather than later. You know, once you start talking about an arsenal that's 15, 20 weapons, you know, then a preventive strike, you know, starts looking more sporty, right? Because as the late President Rafsanjani of Iran once famously said, Israel is a one bomb country. So, you know, the problem for, you know, problem looks different for us than it does for Israel, which I think also is one reason why the Israelis are going to be pretty, you know, pretty much deterred as well. Once, you know, the Iranians get to a point where that's the size of their, you know, their arsenal.
So if you were an Israeli decision maker, let's say you're no longer in the U.S. government, but you're a freelance who's advising the Israeli government, under what circumstances would you be willing to suggest to them a preventive attack on the nuclear Iranian nuclear program?
Now, I'd be thinking about it now. And I would be thinking about it now in the sense that, you know, you and I have both, you know, talked with Amos Yadlin, who was one of the pilots, who was former head of Israeli military intelligence, former defense attaché here in Washington, one of the pilots who flew in the OSIRIC mission in 1981 against the Iraqi nuclear reactor. And I'm sure you've heard him say the same thing I have, which is that when they were briefed and asked, you know, what if they were successful, they would accomplish, the answer was, we'll set the program back by 6 months. Now, in the event, it set the Iraqi nuclear program back by a decade, you know, and you don't really know what you'll accomplish and you don't know, you know, what you'll achieve. There's an argument to be made that you'll just drive their program underground, you'll redouble their commitment to it, et cetera. Or it may actually disable them for quite a period of time. But I would say the earlier you act, the, you know, the better are your chances of success and that your chances of setting them back are greater.
So let's just last question on this. Let's assume that for whatever reason, neither we nor the Israelis launch a preventive attack in the next year or two. And we're in a world where we now think that the Iranians have 15 or 20 nuclear weapons. What does that mean we need to do? I mean, let me posit this to you. Does that mean that we accommodate them? Or does that mean, on the contrary, that we try to find more aggressive but more covert or semi-covert ways of bringing down the regime?
I would say the latter, maybe because the nature of the regime makes a huge difference. And, you know, look, I don't lose any sleep over French nuclear weapons. I don't lose any sleep over British nuclear weapons. I don't lose that much sleep, frankly, over Indian nuclear weapons. I lose a lot of sleep over, Pakistani nuclear weapons, Russian nuclear weapons, North Korean nuclear weapons, and obviously, Iranian nuclear weapons in the hands of this particular regime. So, I would say, again, now is the time to do it, is to redouble the efforts to bring the regime down.
Just to wrap up this part of it, it does seem to me that you're right, but if we do end up in a world where you have more states like this with nuclear weapons, the direction that we'll probably go is, much more intensified forms of political warfare and all the rest. I'm thinking back a little bit to our previous session with Peter Pomerantsev. Okay, let's move to another hard problem. The problem of recalcitrant members of NATO. I'm looking at you, Hungary. For the moment, I'm looking at you, Slovakia, although that can well change. Now, the common understanding of the problem, and you will correct me if I'm wrong, is great. We have 32 members of NATO now, but we need unanimity to do anything. And that means that a member, particularly a member that may in some ways be in the hip pocket of the Russians, can block just about anything. So what the hell do we do about that?
So this was the subject of a piece that my frequent co-author, Frank Miller, a former colleague in government, a longtime defense official, and I wrote with Sir David Manning, a former UK ambassador to the US, but also a former UK ambassador to NATO and former national security advisor to Tony Blair. We were prompted to do this. I mean, Frank and I began thinking about this and kicking it around because of what we saw both Turkey and Hungary doing with the accession of Finland and Sweden, essentially holding that up in exchange for, sort of political considerations to be determined. And started looking into it, and we started to think, are the decision-making procedures of NATO, which originally were conceived at a time when the alliance was formed and had 12 members, still applicable when you now have an alliance of 32. There's a lot of goodness in having, 32 members of NATO, particularly with the addition of Finland and Sweden, which bring a lot of capability and defense industry to the alliance. But it does open you up to the potential for problems. And now, as it turns out, little do you know when you turn over these rocks what you're going to find. So we started from the proposition that the only thing that NATO, that obligates NATO to operate by unanimity legally is the treaty requirement that new members be approved unanimously. And so we've seen that play out. The other operating rule of consensus in the North Atlantic Council is really a norm that developed, over time to enable the alliance to maximize its political element. But we're now talking about potentially very short timelines to respond to a crisis, say with one of the Baltic states, or Poland in the Suwalki Gap between Lithuania and Poland and Belarus and Kaliningrad area. Now, what's interesting is after we published this article, after the Atlantic Council published our article, we got different readings from different former Assistant Secretary Generals of NATO, some of whom told us, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. Once there's an attack, all the member states can contribute, under Article 5. And others who said, no, there's potentially a real problem here because there's a whole issue of NATO common assets, logistics, headquarters, communications, and whether a member state could could block. Now that we in the article consciously did not suggest any specific remedies for this. We just admired the problem. But we did that by intent, because what we wanted to do was to foster a debate in the run-up to the NATO summit in Washington in July, because we do think member states need to think about this a little bit, particularly in light of, you know, the recent visit of Viktor Orban, where he came here, you know, met with former President Trump at Mar-a-Lago, went to the Heritage Foundation, met with a bunch of conservative activists and donors and political figures, apparently some members of Congress, but not anybody in the U.S. administration. And we also, we specifically said in the article, just to finish, we specifically said in the article, we're not talking about what happens if the United States refuses to play ball, which obviously, if Donald Trump is elected in November, could be an even bigger problem.
Right. Well, that's a separate problem. But, you know, I've always thought that one of the things that I always felt was unrealistic about NATO, the way people talk about NATO, is that there was always this kind of tacit assumption that on the day the balloon goes up, all of the members of NATO will simultaneously, cheerfully do exactly everything they've promised to do and march off to war, arm in arm. But, as Churchill would say, bras dessous, bras dessous, I think he said to the French. But, you know, the truth is the history of coalition warfare is a history of allies ratting each other out, of big allies coercing smaller allies or dragging them into a war that they really don't want. If we're going to be realistic, given that, the, you know, for now, for the first time in a very long time, the prospect of a NATO, of a Russian attack on a NATO member is real. I mean, just look at some of the things that the Russians have said about the Baltics. How much should the United States, let's assume the United States has an Atlanticist president, how much should the United States respect those norms or say, hey, Article 5 is self-executing, we're going to use NATO assets to defend the Baltics, and you can argue about that later. That's the first question. But the second question is, how far should we be willing to go to coerce a government which is, as the Soviets might have said, objectively pro-Russian? So those two questions for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, during the Cold War, there was a lot of obfuscation, for instance, about how nuclear release authority would work, right? Because the Supreme Allied Commander was always an American who had pre-delegated authority to use nuclear weapons in the event of a, you know, a Soviet attack. I don't think there was going to be a lot of time for a meeting of the North Atlantic Council. There was a lot of confusion, and I think it was intentional, about exactly how all this would work, because nobody really wanted to get into it in too much, you know, a gory detail for exactly the reasons you have articulated. And we're kind of not quite back in that world yet, but we're kind of there. And I think the real issue is going to be, how do we, I don't think we're going to face an immediate, you know, nuclear release issue, but I think what we are going to face is the potential that we're going to have to work around potentially some recalcitrant allies, notably including the Hungarians, maybe the Turks, maybe the Slovaks. And we have some experience of that, because when France left the integrated military structure but remained in the alliance, it was very obstreperous. But we managed to figure out ways to, you know, work around France and isolate it. And I think we would have to do something like that in these circumstances as well. In essence, it would become a coalition of the willing within NATO, and we would figure out some way to how we would beg, borrow, or steal NATO resources.
So the difference, though, it seems to me, France is a lot bigger than Hungary. But even, you know, in the worst time, there was no question about whose side de Gaulle was on. You know, was he with the West or was he with the Russians? You know, he demonstrated that during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Whereas with Hungary, I'm not sure they're on our side. I think they may be on the other guy's side, or at least their leadership is. I'm not going to speak about the Hungarian people. If that's the case, how coercive should we be willing to be?
You know, it's a good question. And one of the things that, you know, I've been thinking about is that the EU has faced this, right? Because they operate by consensus as well. And on the question, for instance, of beginning accession talks with Ukraine and also coming up with this package of, I think, 50 billion euro of assistance to Ukraine, they've had to work around Hungary, and they've had to sort of get Hungary to sort of leave the room, literally, so that decisions could be made without Hungary sitting there. And I think we'll have to figure out, ways to do that. I would be using coercion against Hungary right now if I were the Biden administration. In other words, I would be making it quite clear, and the U.S. ambassador, Ambassador Pressman, has sort of done that in a speech that he made, but I would do more than speeches. I would make it clear, if you're going to play like that, great. Let's see what you get from us in other areas.
Yeah, you know, in general, just to wrap this one up, it seems to me we've developed a very benign view of alliances as things which are just kind of self-operating. They're just wonderful. And the truth is, the American alliance system is an extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinary achievement. It brings us many good things. But in war, I mean, real war, where people are shooting at you, and all of a sudden, you know, statesmen of different kinds are facing all kinds of decisions that they never really dreamed of, the coalition leader often has to play a lot rougher than one might think. I mean, just think about, say, the Brits and the Norwegians in 1940, or the Brits and the French, for that matter, in 1940, when the Brits turn on the French fleet. And I think there may be a bit of a lesson for us there. I mean, if you read the diplomatic history of World War II, which you know very well, there's a lot of really serious arm twisting that goes on. And people are by and large not very familiar with this. Included us, threatening the French and the Spanish with withholding food imports that they desperately needed. It included threatening the Portuguese so we could get access to the Azores. I mean, we didn't play nice, and you couldn't afford, in a war, you couldn't afford to play nice. The last thing I want to raise is the issue about GOP isolationism. And I think we can stipulate that. I mean, there's some internationalists. Tom Cotton is basically an internationalist, although he's, there's a fair amount of Trumpian rhetoric. Surprise, surprise, most Republicans are falling in line and kissing the ring. Obviously, we've got one kind of catastrophe if Trump is elected. Even if Trump is defeated, do you really believe that the GOP will kind of return, there'll be some sort of reversion to the mean, a GOP which maybe will be more populist, more nationalist, a little bit more isolationist than it used to be, but basically the kind of party that you and I remember and whose presidents you and I both served? Or do you think that GOP is just gone?
Well, let me just say one thing about sort of GOP isolationism and America First, and then I'll try to answer your question. So part of the reason I wrote the essay, which is for Sapir, which is a journal of Jewish thought, as you know, was to talk about the intrinsic connection between America First and anti-Semitism, because I think a lot of people underplay that. The America First movement was totally wrapped up with anti-Semitism. Not everybody who was in America First was an anti-Semite, but pretty much all anti-Semites were in America First. A lot of this had to do with Father Charles Coughlin, a radio priest who was a kind of rank anti-Semite. But even Charles Lindbergh, who was the main public face of America First, used sort of anti-Semitic tropes to explain why Americans supposedly were plumping for war or aid to the Allies, actually, at that point, in order to stave off Hitler in Europe. And allegedly it was because of concerns about, of the American Jewish community for their compatriots suffering in Germany and then more broadly in Europe after the war broke out. And you can see that in today's America First movement, right? I mean, President Trump has had Nick Fuentes, who runs an America First PAC and is an acknowledged anti-Semite. You see it in Tucker Carlson. You see it in any number of other elements. And there's a, as with everything Trump, there's a group that tries to excuse all this and say, well, Trump's really not an anti-Semite. How could he be? His daughter converted to Judaism to marry her husband. And look what he did with the Abraham Accords. And the point I make in the article is, you know, ultimately the America First approach is that your allies are you know, there to be protected as part of a kind of criminal protection racket. And it's not really about ideals and democracy, and that the U.S.-Israel relationship has always been both about interest and ideals. And a America First approach inevitably is going to be incredibly corrosive of that relationship. You can begin to see that already now. Now, the question is, if Trump is defeated, by the way, my first recommendation in the article is that to defeat this, you know, we've got to defeat Trump at the ballot box. Of course, too late now in the Republican Party, he's going to be the nominee. So I think he has to be defeated at the polls in November. And then we have to see whether, you know, whether there's a reversion to the norm or whether the rot is too deep. I mean, look, I can imagine a world in which Trump is defeated at the polls and immediately announces he's going to be a candidate after a lot of, you know, violence and uproar, maybe a bloodbath or two, you know, that he will then announce he's going to run again in you know, 2028. And that it'll completely immobilize the party. Even if he doesn't, it's very likely that you'll get some other Trumpist candidates like J.D. Vance or Josh Hawley running on an explicitly America First, you know, platform. Now, I don't think necessarily that any of them would immediately have the kind of sway that Trump does, but that we don't know. We'd have to see. I mean, obviously the experience of Ron DeSantis running as, you know, Trump without the baggage didn't turn out too well. But we'll have to, you know, we'll have to really see. I think the odds are that the party has now become so corrupted by this that it's impossible, you know, for it to be rehabilitated, I think. But it's a little too early to tell. And as Liz Cheney said when we had her on, when you asked her a similar question, I think right now the overwhelming thing is to defeat Trump. Then after that, we'll have to see whether the GOP is you know, can be rehabilitated or whether we need a new conservative party of some kind or a realignment of the Democratic Party.
I have to say, when we had that great discussion with Liz Cheney, I was somewhat surprised that at the end, when I put a similar question to her, I think it seemed to me that she was leaving the door open to the idea that we'll need another party. And I have to say, that's sort of where my heart is. Well, Eric, I did my best to pin you down. I don't know if I succeeded entirely. But if you keep on writing, I'm going to keep on trying. So how's that?
Yeah, I was trying to wriggle out of having to provide any real answers because admiring the problem is so much easier.
It did not escape my notice, but I did my best to take another pin and, you know, get you down there. But thank you. I mean, those, you know, these are incredibly hard problems. And I do think, you know, when you really try to force yourself to think about, okay, concretely, what would I do? It gets to be very hard. I mean, somebody who we both admire a lot, Rema Daron, I think in his memoirs describes how early on, he was criticizing some French government of something, and the minister of, I think it was the minister of foreign affairs, calls him in and says, okay, Monsieur Aron, that's a brilliant article. What would you have me do? And Aron just kind of looked at him, and he said from then on, he decided he wasn't going to criticize the government unless he thought he had a better idea. Now, I'm not sure he adhered to that. I'm not sure I have. I'm not sure you have. But it's not a bad principle to keep in the back of your mind, I think, don't you?
I agree. And, the other thing one has to keep in mind is, you know, to paraphrase one of my former bosses, you know, you go to war with the government and the alliance you have, not the one you want. And one, when you were asking, would I recommend a, you know, preemptive strike on, you know, on the Iranian nuclear program or a preventive strike? You know, I pause because, you know, for instance, although I'm going to, you know, vote for Joe Biden because I, you know, think it's imperative that we stop Donald Trump, I will do it, you know, without, you know, a lot of joy in my heart, because I've been very critical, as you have, of a lot of the, you know, way they've handled the war in Ukraine and, you know, how they've responded to the Houthis, et cetera. You have to put yourself in the mind that, okay, these are the people who are going to be executing the preventive strike. And, you know, will they do it in a way that will actually accomplish the objective? Or is there more of a chance that it will be done in a kind of half-assed fashion that'll create more problems than it solves?
Yeah, I have to say that, I mean, that has been one of my principles, that there's no platonic ideal of a policy. There's only policy that can be executed by the current group of people who are in government, and that, you know, people like us who are on the outside who are criticizing need to bear that in mind, that it, and not just criticizing, but also advising. You know, it's a mistake to recommend a course, a policy course, which, you know, you fundamentally don't think people, for whatever reason, are going to be able to follow through on. It may not be because they're talented enough. It may just be because they're too tired. I mean, I did have an experience like that at the end of the Bush administration, where somebody came in with a brilliant plan for how to rearrange the politics of Iraq and all that. And I, you know, the end, he said, so you're going to take that to the secretary? I said, no. And he said, why? And he said, you think it's a bad idea? I said, no, I don't think it's a bad idea. It's just, these people are all completely exhausted and they want to be able to just get through their term, hand things off in as good shape as possible to their successors. But there's not enough energy in the system to be able to carry through a policy, which at a different time might very well have been the right policy. And I think that's often the case. So, all right, that's what passes for the milk of human kindness on Shield of the Republic.
Well, thank you, Elliot, both for the kind words, but also for putting me through my paces, because, of course, it's always a good exercise to say, okay, you've identified the problem. Now, what's your solution?
Yeah, I'm only afraid you'll do it to me. But until next time, thanks, Eric.
All right.